Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:41 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is August 25th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought I'd kick off with this graphic that Larry Summers posted on Twitter today. I think it originated with the Washington Post, but it does help to graphically illustrate the points that I was making in last week's big picture audio and video. So we are at a pivotal point. We've had inflation bobbing around at an unremarkable level for the last several years. Then it stormed higher in the aftermath of the pandemic and has started to come back down again in response to much tighter monetary policy. Although it would be difficult to rationalize that in terms of the kinds of deficits that the US government are currently running and the fiscal stimulus that that represents. But it does bring us to the point of what happens next. So either we're going to move into a deflationary environment where inflation continues to come down, and it comes back down well inside the previous range, and it affords the Federal Reserve the opportunity to say job done, and then subsequently that they can start cutting interest rates, and then potentially inflation would start to ramp higher again, or there is the possibility that there would be another kind of external shock. And the external shock in the 1970s was the Arab oil embargo. Now, of course, that there are a couple of different ways of explaining what the rationale for that was. Some people will say that it was because of the Yom Kippur War. In 1973, and the assistance that the US government gave to Israel that scuppered the attempts of Syria and Egypt to take over the country. So the Arabs rebelled at that idea. But of course, that would be to ignore the other factors that led up to it, which was the massive devaluation of the US dollar all the way through the early part of the 1970s. And of course, that devaluation of the dollar was in response to the massive spending that had gone on ahead of that, and to the devaluation of the currency inside an environment where there was still a gold peg and the reserves of the USA were being called on. So the gold was leaving the country at an accelerating pace. So there were lots of different factors that were going on in the early 1970s. And of course, then we also had the Vietnam War in the late 1960s. So there's really a lot of different factors that were contributing to a very difficult environment. But what I find especially interesting today is the confluence of factors, that it's not simply that the trajectory of inflation is relatively similar, but that we also have a lot of social factors that are taking place. That on the one hand, there was the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Then we had the pandemic in this cycle, and we had a lot of calls for redistribution of wealth, for the closing of the income gap, for inequality to be addressed. And there is also then this growing trend, which is inevitable in coming election cycles in most countries. There's going to be a generation war. And there was a bit of that in the late 1960s as well, because at the time it was the large number of people that were born after the Second World War were clamoring for work opportunities and for opportunities to improve their living standards. And there was a massive building boom that went on, and that took money. And on top of that, there was a lot of war spending. So there was a social upheaval, and then there was a fiscal response. And that then created significant debt issues eventually that had to be unwound. By the time we got to the end of the 1970s, debt to GDP ratios had largely been corrected. And then disinflationary forces could take effect. So now let's think about, well, what are we looking at right now? So I think there are a couple of different things that need to be considered. So the first thing is that debt to GDP, or excuse me, the deficit right now in the USA is at about 8.5% on the downside. Now, we have lots of back history for this kind of data. We can definitely see that there were deficits that were being run in the 19, well, and let's just put this into perspective. I think there is also this very clear correlation. The last time that the US had been running a surplus was in the late 1960s, and whenever politicians are presented with money they have to spend, then they go overboard. And that's what happened in the 1970s. They spent their way into trouble. And the last time that there was a budget surplus in the USA was at the end of the 1990s, and then they spent their way into trouble as well. And deficits are continuing to expand. But the size of the deficit now is nothing compared to the size of the deficit back in the 1970s. And it's worth considering, too, that even during the recovery from the 1980s onwards, that did not correct the deficit. And it really wasn't until the tech bubble really started to get going in the early 1990s that was the causal factor behind a big swell in government income. So I think that's one important factor. That's a key differentiation between where we are at the present moment and what was present in the late 1960s. And then this is another way of looking at it, that you have the debt to GDP ratio, and that debt right now is in excess of 120% of GDP. And back in the early 1970s, it was less than 40. So not only do we have these very large deficits, but then on top of that, the vast quantity of debt outstanding is another very different factor compared to what we had back then. So one would then think that perhaps there would be a greater a chance that inflationary pressures are not going to come back down, that perhaps they are going to continue to move higher. But then we also have the bigger point here, that the size of the Fed's balance sheet continues to contract, and it has contracted by about 90, excuse me, 900 billion over the course of the last year. So that's a fairly significant move, and we're ramping up on the trillion mark, and probably going to hit that before the end of the third quarter. So the Federal Reserve is certainly taking money out of the system. Now, when we think about the inflationary problem, and then the continued march higher of bond yields, and then let's think about, well, what are the Fed's mandates? Well, one mandate that they have is to pursue full employment, and one is to control inflation. But there would be, I think, the corollary then would be that there's a third one, which would be that they need to create a an attractive market so that people will be encouraged to buy treasuries. So if we view it from that perspective, then the chances are that they are going to keep interest rates higher for longer. They want to avoid the inflationary outcome that came as a result of the oil shock in the 1970s. And the primary reason for that is because unemployment went through the roof during the 1970s, and it didn't peak until the early 1980s. And I think that's a very clear example of just how much of a lagging indicator unemployment is. So it trended higher. Not only did it pop higher in the early 1970s, but it popped higher in response to the oil shock, and then it popped higher again during the recession at the beginning of the 1980s. And it didn't really peak until 1982. So that was well after interest rates had already started to come back down. And that was also when stocks were beginning to break on the upside. So the thing that the Federal Reserve definitely wants to avoid is a massive uptrend in unemployment. And not only do we have the fact that unemployment is right in the region of the lows from the late 1960s. And this is despite the fact that we've had an inflationary shock. So if inflation doesn't come back down, then it's eventually going to contribute to a jump in inflationary pressures, excuse me, unemployment pressures. Now, then let's just think about what's happening in the bond markets. So the 10-year yield today popped on the upside in early trading and then finished in negative territory. And we're right in the region of the upper side of this range that's been underway now since October of last year. And the bigger point here is that if the Federal Reserve is going to hold higher rates higher for longer, then that is eventually going to get inflationary pressures under control. And then it does beg the question, well, what would then get inflation to surge on the upside again subsequently? So I think it's important to in the only possible way, I guess, that we can really get through talking about this issue is to talk about it sequentially. Because it's no point saying, well, inflation down first and then up, but rather we have inflation that was high and it is coming down now. So inflationary pressures are moderating. And at the same time, interest rates are still high. So we have really quite positive real interest rates. And it's easy to graph that. So the Federal Reserve provides us with a chart to do that. And real rates have popped on the upside. So they're up to nearly 200 basis points. And that's on the 10-year. And that's certainly something that is going to encourage some demand. That and one thing that I've definitely noticed is that the more institutional investors I talk to, and they don't like looking at valuations on the tech sector and trying to justify a rationale for why they need to become fully invested when valuations are this high. Instead, they are more than happy to just take the 5% guaranteed from the 2-year and not worry too much about some missed opportunity in the stock market when valuations are this high. So, what's going to encourage that money in off the sideline? Well, I think something that would clearly encourage that money in off the sideline would be if interest rates start to go down. Well, then your guaranteed yield isn't going to be as attractive, even if the nominal price of the bond starts to appreciate. So you'll get the capital appreciation, you probably won't. And of course, the yield will then be dependent on just how competitive it is relative to what's happening in the wider market. But that would probably at least help to also support stocks. If interest rates start to eventually come down, then the growthy part of the market should start to benefit. And with stronger performance in the wider stock market rather than a small number of large cap companies, and the potential that they will continue to do well, then some of that money will come in off the sidelines. But I think that as we look at the positive real rate continuing to ramp higher, and we still have very tight monetary conditions, and we have banks that are not looking like they're in great shape. So when we think about the regional banks, they pulled back really sharply from the region of the 200-day moving average 3 weeks ago and the lower side of the overhead trading range, and they continue to extend that decline. The S&P 500 banks are not really showing a lot of confidence either and remain under pressure. And then we can look at international banking indexes, our indices, and the FTSE 350 bank index has also pulled back to test its sequence of higher reaction lows. What I find especially interesting at present is that it is the European banks have exhibited relative strength and are still holding here in the region of the upper side of the range. And the Japanese banks had been resurgent last week. Now, the Japanese market pulled back rather sharply in here over the last week, but the banking index has been a source of relative strength. So, what we can definitely see here is that it is the US banking sector is most susceptible to additional downside. And the underperformance of the banks in an environment where monetary conditions are tightening, that's not great news for the economy. And then, of course, when we look at the yield curve spread, well, it contracted again over the last couple of days. And I do not know why this chart never seems to update to the most recent data. But it is still trending downwards, even though we've had a little bit of steadier action more recently around the 100 basis points to the downside level. And we are in the region of the lows from all the way back in the late 1970s. So there's no question that monetary conditions are tightening up, but fiscal conditions are still extremely accommodative. And as long as that remains the case, well, then that is certainly something that is helping to support the stock market. And I think that's where you have the confusion that most people are now looking at the market and thinking, well, valuations are high, so why aren't stocks pulling back? And monetary conditions are tight, and usually that would contribute to weaker stock performance. But of course, when the US government is running a deficit of 8.5% relative to the total GDP, that is an awful lot of money that is out there looking for a home, and a lot of spending that's going on. So then that is helping to support markets. It's the primary reason why we haven't had a deeper process of consolidation overall. So even though Jay Powell today was speaking at Jackson Hole, saying higher for longer, definitely going to hold on to the 2% inflation target, then stocks went up, then down, then came back up again, and still steady here in the region of the 4,500 level and above the 200-day moving average. Now, I think that's primarily because of the size of the fiscal stimulus that is underway. Now, let's think about the dollar, and what could be a shock that would push inflationary pressures higher in future. I am very much of the opinion. And in fact, I am increasingly convinced that the reason that the Federal Reserve has been so aggressive in getting inflation under control is primarily to defend the reserve currency status of the dollar and to create a benign market environment for demand for treasuries, because China's not buying treasuries, neither is Japan, and neither is Saudi Arabia. So the traditional, I guess, automatic buyers of treasuries are no longer doing so. And with the government running such enormous deficits, then they have to encourage demand from other sources. And the easy way to do that is with higher yields. And a higher interest rate differential is certainly in favor of the dollar. So, with a stronger currency and higher yields on the bond market, that will eventually start to create demand for treasuries. And then let's just spin it back and think about, well, what was quantitative easing viewed as when it was initially introduced in response to the global financial crisis 15 years ago? Well, it was primarily talked about in terms of displacing the interests of savers in favor of speculators. And of course, the big savers that are no longer buying those treasuries are China, Japan, and Saudi Arabia. But of course, it's also been a major contributor to the rise of political populism, because a lot of the regular consumers that would have historically put their money in the bank and been quite happy to get a return in terms of bank interest were getting nothing at all. And then the people that speculated and borrowed to speculate, then they've amassed enormous fortunes. So when we think about what that meant, that savers were robbed at the expense of speculators, Well, what it also meant was that the USA was abusing its status as a reserve currency holder. So, in the intervening decade, we've had the creation of competing international institutions, certainly by China and its development banks, and then the USA using the SWIFT mechanism as a weapon of financial destruction against Russia that alerted lots of other countries to the risks of dealing with the USA. And then, of course, there's been a lot of speculation about de-dollarization. Now, then you have the BRICS meeting that's underway in South Africa at present time. And what they're discussing is the creation of an alternative currency union. Well, I guess that is the headline. It's probably much more likely that they'll end up using more renminbi for bilateral trade. And that's an affront to the dollar's reserve currency status. So then, from the Federal Reserve's perspective, in ensuring the demand for the dollar and faith in the dollar, then they need to raise interest rates. They need to ensure that there will be demand for the currency. And I think that is at least as important as getting inflation under control. And but in, I think in all practicality, it's a dual it's a dual policy initiative, and one hand will rub the other in terms of both those objectives. Now, the dollar index is back testing the sequence of lower rally highs, and on each occasion that it has popped back above the 200-day moving average over the course of this year, it has failed. So we're now at a pivotal point for the dollar. And then when you have real rates that are ramping higher and a firmer dollar, well, then that does tend to take some of the impetus out of gold. Now, the gold price is back in the region of $1,900 in the region of the 200-day moving average. And it also rebounded in here this week, and it closed well off the lows in here today. So this is beginning to look like at least a short-term bottom. And silver has done much better, and it has rebounded really quite impressively from the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, it has not quite yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs, but that is a good-sized upward dynamic in what has been really quite an exceptional period of volatility for the price overall. I think one of the things that's most important here is that the more back history you look at, the more that this looks like a first step above the base. And considering where prices are right now, then I remember when David and I were first started working together back in 2003, we were looking at the breakout that silver had put in. And we were thinking that it would eventually take out the peak from the Bunker Hunt bubbly environment in the early 1980s. Well, it did that in 2011. It went above the $40 previous peak. I'm just going to pull back the data and see if we can get all of it. But it did make a new peak around the 50 level. And I suspect that given where the price has consolidated over the course of the last 10 years, that when it does break on the upside on this occasion, well, then it could easily be at $40 in a fairly short period of time, and it could easily take out the peak around $50 in another big bull market. But in order for that bull market to really take place, then we would have to see a significant debasement of currency. Now, then that does beg the question. If interest rates are going up right now and they get inflation back down and it stays down, well, then the sustainability of the debt is going to be less of an issue. So I remain very much of the view that we are heading towards a deflationary outcome in the near term, so over the next year. And there are going to be some significant issues for the US economy over the next 6 months. When 40 million people have to start paying their student loans again, then that's going to be a significant drag. And use of credit cards is rising once more, and the average balance is up to about $3,600 from a high of $3,000. So that's certainly representative of increasing demand for credit. And then there have been Fed estimates about when savings are going to be eroded. Savings jumped in response to the massive accommodation during the pandemic, and then subsequently has been falling as people have been spending to support their lifestyles. And that could also be fully eroded by the time we get into the third quarter. So we're going to start to see that consumers are going to experience some stress, and eventually that will contribute to interest rates starting to come back down. And then, of course, we will have the bigger question. If interest rates start to come down, and then the consumer is under pressure, then how much assistance will the Federal Reserve provide? And if they do start to provide additional assistance, how long will it stay in the system? And that, I think, is by far the biggest uncertainty in the market today. If we are still in a an environment similar to what we've had over the last 20 years, then they'll probably leave the assistance in the market too long and create the next inflationary problem. And that is, I think, what people who think we're in a new inflationary environment believe. And if they instead move into a different environment where central banks have been sufficiently chastened by their experience with inflation, well, then they're not going to leave all of that assistance in the market too long. They'll be quick to withdraw it, and that will then result in less inflation later. So that, of course, is what the Federal Reserve is thinking about right now. And when they talk about the totality of data, those are the kinds of things that they're going to be thinking about. But of course, trying to create an environment which will be benign for demand for treasuries does not mean that the people who would normally be buying them will continue to. And it's worth considering that oil prices are still holding the move above the 200-day moving average. And the oil price was quite steady in here this week, up another dollar in here today. So beginning to find support here. And from just a pure technical perspective, oil prices have broken the downtrend. And therefore, as long as it is holding the region of the 200-day moving average, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Well, that does hold out the prospect of significantly higher oil prices over the next several months. And that would certainly be something that would cut into demand in the wider economy. Now, the other big important point is that Ukraine does not look like it's going to win this war in the eastern part of their country against Russia. And they basically got pulled into trying to defend Bakhmut in the early part of this year, which was effectively a stalling tactic by Russia. And Russia used that time to build trenches, to put in substantial minefields, and to build ramparts all along the frontier. So it's increasingly difficult for Ukraine to make any ground. And the summer offensive has so far failed. Now, that doesn't mean they won't punch through eventually. They might be able to capture some additional territory, but it's going to be a lot harder. And Russia would appear to be in this for the long haul. Well, that basically means that we're going to be in a tense geopolitical environment for the foreseeable future. The longer that war goes on in eastern Ukraine, then the greater the advantage Russia has in terms of material and men. And they made the determination early on and followed the Russian playbook for deterring invaders, which has been to use human walls, and they've been throwing large numbers of men at the artillery provided to Ukraine by NATO. And their bet has been a simple but grisly one, which is that they would that NATO would run out of armaments before Russia would run out of men and old tanks that missiles would be required to blow up. So that's essentially where we are right now. It basically also means that there's going to be upward pressure on oil prices as long as the global economy is still expanding. Transportation and oil demand generally tend to be something that everyone is paying attention to. One thing that I think is most especially relevant right now is that the LME Metals Index is just about steady and right in the region of the lower side of its range. And the quite clear divergence that we have between oil and metals suggests that one of the bigger issues out here is China. Now, when I think about where global deflationary pressures could arise from, I think China has to be front and center. And what they're doing is quite similar to what the USA is doing. And the CSI 300 continues to deteriorate. Now, we've definitely seen a bit more steadier action in the H shares in Hong Kong, but still not in an especially dynamic manner. And what China is doing is attempting to unwind the leverage in their property sector. They have reached the conclusion that exceptionally high prices with the income to price level in excess of 40 for the tier one cities, that it is not conducive to social cohesion. So they are attempting to unwind the leverage in the system, which means that there will be less building. And if there's less building, there's going to be less demand for copper, aluminium, and nickel, or zinc, or tin, or lead. And those are certainly contributing to the underperformance of the LME Metals Index. Longer term, China is probably seeking to correct its over-leverage and debt issues now, ahead of when they really come to a head for much of the rest of the world. Because with the significant deficits and the rising number of elderly people, then the ability to fund pensions, to fund healthcare services, and also then to supply the military with the tools that it needs in order to defend against potential aggression in Eastern Europe, then those are all major centers for expenditure. When we think about the kinds of factors that contribute to the sovereign, the reserve currency status migrating from one country to another, well, then that is certainly also the biggest catalyst for those kinds of moves tend to be wars, where the holder of the reserve currency status loses and then ends up in a debt spiral environment. But this is some that is a longer term challenge, which probably will play out towards the end of this decade. In the meantime, the push and pull between these two competing forces, where China is attempting to delever to make its market more attractive, and the USA is attempting to support the dollar in order to make its market more attractive. But that is all part of a broader pattern of activity, which is aimed at ensuring greater comparative advantage. And of course, in between those two major economic zones, you have all the other markets that are going to prosper by playing them off against each other. So the Nifty Index was in negative territory this week, and it is beginning to unwind its short-term overbought condition. But India is in a very strong position to benefit overall. Now, the Indian rupee, it has been holding the region of its lows for most of this year, and it bounced for most of the days this week, but was in mildly negative territory in here today. Now, we can see from this longer term chart that the number of times when the rupee has traded through the 200-day moving average have been really quite rare. But on each of the occasions that it has done or has traded through the 200-day moving average, those have generally been among the most rewarding times to be in the Indian market. But then let's just think about the fact that there are plenty of currencies that have outperformed the dollar this year. And the majority of the best performers are in Latin America. So the Colombian peso is up 17.5% this year relative to the dollar. And the Mexican peso is up over 16%. And the Brazilian real is up over 8%. And then we've also obviously had a significant depreciation in the Japanese yen, and it's down over 10% this year. But then other currencies where there have been significant economic problems, like Argentina or Turkey, those currencies have pulled back very violently. And then the Swedish krona is down over 5%, and they're going through their own difficulties in terms of the domestic housing market, taking a hit as interest rates have moved higher. So I do think that Mexico is going to be among the countries that does best from redistribution of globalization focus. So the iShares MSCI Mexico ETF continues to bounce from the region of the 200-day moving average. And the Mexican peso, and it does certainly helps when you type in the right ticker, has been trending in really quite a dynamic and consistent manner for all of this year. And this is a really quite profound change of trend overall. And it's been a very long time since we've seen this kind of strength coming through in the Mexican peso. So of course, that's not going to help in terms of labor productivity, but the competitive advantage that Mexico has relative to other nearshoring or friendshoring candidates is clear with its land border with the USA. And of course, nothing I've talked about so far has included a discussion about technology. And the best performing stocks this year have either been in the tourist industry. A lot of the or the cruise liners have been among the best performers on the S&P 500 because of renewed demand from Chinese tourists. And then, of course, Nvidia has been the go-to share for the AI revolution. And one thing that I thought is interesting this week was that Nvidia reported earnings and they were better than expected. And the options market had priced in exactly a 10% move on the upside. And in the after hours, it did get up to $525. But then by the time the share had actually opened, it had come back down again. And it has failed to sustain the move above the $500 level. We're at extraordinarily rarefied territory, and there has been incredible excitement around artificial intelligence. And the large language models that have been developed, or I guess released over the last year, they're very impressive. And I'll be speaking at the American Association of Professional Technical Analysts conference in the middle of September, and they asked me for a bio. So I went to ChatGPT and I said, write a bio for Owen Tracy. And I will say that it was better than anything I could have written myself, because what it does is it goes off and it scrapes the entire internet and it comes back with anything that's been written about you in the past. So anything that has been written about me tends to pop up in that biography. So that makes something that is what I personally find to be a very unpleasant task, writing about myself. It makes it very easy. And I think those are the kinds of things where it will be beneficial. Now, of course, one thing that it's not going to be great at is value added, where it has to come up with new information or a new interpretation. What artificial intelligence is very good at is scraping the internet and putting together pieces of information relating to a topic. Some of them will be relevant, some of them won't, but it is a wonderful tool for creating a draft. And I suspect that is where, and of course, creating a draft is a very significant piece of work. There was a delegate at the Chart seminar, I think it was last year. He was saying that one of the diplomatic tools that France uses when they're negotiating with the EU is that they will always volunteer to write the draft, because the draft document is the basis for which all other negotiations come from. So that's a significant piece of work that no one else really wants to do, but it does confer an advantage. And I suspect that that is exactly how people are going to be using artificial intelligence. And that really is a significant boost in terms of productivity. It doesn't mean that the person who is using it is suddenly going to be no longer useful, unless all they do is scrape the internet and regurgitate what they find on it. I think the vast majority of people are employed because of the value added that they can offer, and that's not something that's about to be displaced by artificial intelligence in the short term. Now, when we think about where the potential is, well, large language models are one piece of artificial intelligence. And then you have another piece, which I think is now more correctly termed big data, which was what artificial intelligence was considered to be only a few years ago. But big data takes objective reality and looks at objective results that come through in the various parts of business, whether that is in the biotech sector or in drilling results. And then it goes through those. And it finds useful information. So that's not quite the same as trawling the internet and coming up with subjective answers, because if you're looking at objective data, then you can come up with an objective answer, and that's where big data comes in. Well, if we think about the kinds of ways that that has been used in the past, if we think about Goldcorp, they went through the drilling and they had a competition, and this was 20 years ago. And they asked for somebody to come up with an answer where it was the best place to drill. Well, that was an early application of big data. So that's certainly something that has improved considerably. And we're going to see more of that. So when we think about the biotechnology sector, we're seeing rapid drug discovery is a reality today. Now, there is a blindingly small number of companies that are actually focusing on it, and David Brown's Helix would be one of those. But it is certainly something that is going to accelerate the pace of drug discovery over the course of the next decade. It does not simplify or speed up the clinical trials process, but it certainly helps to find high probability candidates that will successfully navigate the clinical trials process. So that's certainly something that's coming in the biotechnology sector. The challenge in terms of the ETF is that it is primarily made up of companies that aren't particularly adept at deploying these new methods. And they don't represent a big proportion of their income. So there's a little bit of a developmental hiccup in terms of the performance of the stocks relative to what's incredibly exciting in terms of the technology that is approaching commerciality. And of course, then we also have the very real potential for big data to be used in terms of drill results from oil and gas, and that could potentially revolutionize the production of oil. Now, when we think about the oil market, we've had a really significant advance in oil shares because of outsized profitability during 2022, and those shares are back in the region of their peak, and oil prices are steadying. With the continued advance in the US economy, and China might be slowing down and deleveraging, but the consumer is still reasonable, so that is encouraging energy demand. There is, I think it's a very interesting situation that we have in oil markets where prices are steadying, but then we have efforts underway to sign a deal to increase production from Iran. And an effort to withdraw subsidies on Venezuela, excuse me, sanctions on Venezuela to boost production there. And at the same, even though those would be good news stories, prices are still rising. So there is also an assumption within the energy markets that the boom in shale has peaked and that production will become more expensive as we go forward in the primary shale basins like the Permian in Texas. Now, that I think is still a little early to make that determination because there hasn't been a lot of money going into drilling when there is so much political backlash. And has the fall off in drilling, or I guess in production growth, been more about less drilling or about the maturation of the fields? And then the question of technological innovation on whether refracking will be possible. So there's certainly a lot of moving parts within the energy sector, and I think monitoring the charts and the consistency of the breakout we've seen in the oil market will be particularly important. Now, the oil services sector has been trending higher in a mild manner for the last 4 years, and it's overbought in the short term, and it has a history of failing to sustain upward breaks, so we could easily see it coming back down into the region of the 200-day moving average. With oil prices quite firm and a lot of concern right now about what's going to happen in terms of renewable energy, well, then uranium prices are starting to push on the upside. And the Global X Uranium ETF is at a new closing high for the last 12 months. So that's certainly showing more bullish action overall. Now, the clear outperformance of Cameco in Canada is very clear, and it continues to accelerate higher. And eventually, we're going to see a downward dynamic, and that will cap the advance. And then Kazatomprom, which is listed on the US, or excuse me, it's in the London market, but dollar denominated, is now back above its 200-day moving average. And then you have Centrus Energy, which is in the process of building out a capacity for high assay, low enriched uranium, which is anything from 5 to 20% intensity. And that's what's going to be used in molten salt reactors, and the first of those is being built right now. So I think we are entering a period where there will be more acceptance of Generation 4 and advanced nuclear designs, which have low probability of proliferation and will provide the base load electricity to try and reduce carbon emissions. But then I think it's also rather interesting here that while uranium is doing quite well, the hydrogen stocks are not. And hydrogen has been one of the darlings of the green industry. And The shares are really performing terribly. So the Global X hydrogen ETF continues to trend downwards. Ceres Power was one of the original companies in the UK, and the UK has got probably more of the hydrogen global market for companies than most other countries. And the share has continued to trend lower over the last 3 years. Now, potentially, it's putting in a higher reaction low now, but it's got some work to do. There's no question of that. And obviously, hydrogen is going to have to come up with a major technological innovation in order to reduce the cost of production. Now, nuclear is obviously an answer to that. But of course, if you have cheap nuclear energy, why do you have to go off and build hydrogen? Why not just put in more transmission cables and electrify everything? Then that would push the pressure for innovation onto the battery sector. And that, I think, is one of the big missing ingredients in the global technology sector today. It's that solid-state batteries were promised in 2017, 19, 21, 23, 25, and I saw an estimate today that they will really be commercial in 2028. So the dates keep getting pushed back for highly advanced batteries that are energy dense, will charge quickly, and will provide the kind of range on a vehicle that will be competitive with an internal combustion engine. And that is something that's going to get pushed out progressively. Now, of course, when they're eventually delivered, we're going to have an energy revolution. And all these really interesting robots, whether it's the General Dynamics ones or the Boston Dynamics ones, those little robot dogs, or the robot androids that can carry boxes and do somersaults and dance, or Tesla's new Optimus robot, what they need is a power supply. In fact, going back to the Terminator movie, it was the miniaturized fusion reactor inside the robot was the thing that drove the whole thing. And it's the power supply is something that is going to be absolutely integral to the evolution of the electric vehicle sector, and to basically the robotics sector, as robots move away from being harnessed to individual power supply and become entirely more mobile. And of course, as we look towards the future, well, higher inflation rates and the need to do more with less, well, then that does improve technological innovation. And it's really only the best of the ideas will gain funding in a tight liquidity environment. And of course, then you have Tesla with its autonomous driving. And the share is steadying from the region of the 200-day moving average. And this is more, I think, on the promise of the delivery of the Cybertruck than anything to do with autonomy. California is throwing the rule book out the window, and they have basically allowed autonomous vehicles to traverse the roads of the state. Now, individual cities have told companies like General Motors, Cruise, or Waymo, which is owned by Google, that they need to reduce the number of autonomous vehicles on the roads because they're crashing. But the more data that they get, and of course, this is, I think, the biggest big data problem there is. And the way that companies are addressing it is just a very interesting science experiment, because Google is relying on maps, and they have mapped the entire country and lots of different countries, and they're going to use that to train their automotives, and then they will use onboard pattern recognition to try and avoid obstacles. Whereas what Tesla is attempting to do is to create an artificial intelligence system that can make decisions on the fly, like a human can. Now, that is a much more difficult science experiment, but it is probably something that is necessary in order to achieve full autonomy. Because maps are not 100%, and you do need the fast computing power. But are we there yet in terms of fast computing power? Is a big question. Now, Google was in, our Alphabet was in negative territory today, but it is rebounding from the region of the 200-day moving average. I definitely think that as we look at the banking sector and it's under pressure, it's also worth considering that the fintech sector has been basing now for a year, and PayPal was in positive territory in here this week. So it has, this is the first up week after four consecutive down weeks, or three consecutive down weeks, I should say. And then Square is still trending downwards. Well, PagSeguro came through with their earnings in here today, and they were down on earnings, but then showed a bit better guidance, and the share popped back up on the upside. And that is a Brazilian fintech, and Brazilian interest rates are coming back down, and Brazil is at a point where they have conquered inflation. Now they have to ensure that they're going to conquer deflationary pressures. And obviously, as a major commodity exporter, they could really benefit from higher commodity prices. They might well get that from the oil price. And Petrobras is still at the upper side of the range that's been forming for the last 5 or 6 years. But and that is also helping to support the Brazilian stock market, the Bovespa. They may not get the same kick from demand for the kinds of commodities that Vale produces, which are iron ore and nickel. And I think what's happening in China is a big spanner in the works in terms of the growth in demand for commodities. Then, obviously, Australia has become what is, I think, really another Norway in terms of its dominance of the global LNG market. They look like they have pretty much solved the strike action by workers at both Chevron and Woodside, and that is likely to put downward pressure on natural gas prices. But natural gas is unlikely to come all the way back down because of the absence of one of the biggest suppliers in the world, Russia. So we could be in a higher for longer energy environment. And of course, that is also it's a very important trend to monitor because of the symmetry that we have with the 1970s. And just to be very clear, I anticipate that inflation is going to continue going down, that I think it will come back down below 2%. And then subsequently, there will be deflationary fears will arise, and we will have a recession at some point over the next year. Then subsequently, we'll have a significant recovery in asset prices as monetary accommodation becomes more available. And then we'll see what happens in terms of central bank action. They may have learned their lesson and take it back faster. And if that's the case, we will see inflation overcome. And that will then lend much greater assistance to the technology sector overall. And it will be less of a factor for supporting inflationary trends overall. If they have not learned their lesson at that stage, and then inflation could really turn into a 1970s problem, and we would have much higher in, unemployment overall. So I think in the short term, stock markets are still steady and they're being supported by deficits. eventually deflationary forces will overcome and we'll have a deeper correction. Then subsequently, we'll get a bigger recovery overall. But we have definitely seen that a lot of the growthy part of the market has put in a year-long basis already. And an easy way to monitor that would be the ARK Innovation ETF. And it's steadying right now in the region of the 200-day moving average. So the base is still underway. It has not broken out of the base, and it might be a while before it does. But there's a good chance that a lot of the selling pressure has already taken place in the most growthy part of the market. And eventually, this big bull market will not end until the mega cap companies roll over relative to the wider market. And that's not readily apparent right now. They're still holding this range above the all-time peak. And as long as that remains the case, then I don't think anyone is going to be particularly worried about profit erosion. It's when this ratio really does roll over. It looked like it was doing it in 2022, and then it came roaring back this year. When it eventually does roll over, then that is going to be a better sign of a deeper pullback in the stock market. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.